Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. You can watch today's program by going to ustream.tv and searching for Gary Knoll. The theme today is NATO's mission to militarize the world and intervening on behalf of U.S. interest. My panel includes Rick Rozoff. He's been an active opponent of war, militarism, and the interventions for over 40 years. He is the manager of Stop NATO and its internet activities, which focuses on the threat of international militarization, especially through globalization of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is NATO. Rick has written over 300 articles on international affairs. He has frequently published on the Center for Research and Globalization and Voltaire Net, and his research and writings are frequently cited into the investigations into postmodern geopolitics. And his website is rick.wordpress.com. He is joined from San Francisco by Professor Stephen Zunis. Professor Zunis is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He is recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of the Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. He received his doctorate from Cornell University and has previously been on the faculty of Ithaca College, University of Puget Sound, and Whitman College. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies and as an associate editor of Peace Review. He is also a contributing editor and academic advisor to the Committee for the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict. Among his publications, the most recent is Western Zaire, War, Nationalism, and the Conflict Irresolution. Earlier, he wrote Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, co-written with Richard Falk. His website is stephenzunis.org. I welcome both of you to our program.
Good to be with you.
As anyone who's listened to the Progressive Commentary Hour, I give an extended introduction, but then it is more like a classroom on the air, where we invite our guests to take their time, no interruptions, and really give us the full context of your thoughts on the issue. And we're going to begin with you, Rick. I want to read a short paragraph from the former Assistant Secretary General for the United Nations, Dennis Halliday, because I feel it provides a perception about the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, which most people are unfamiliar with. It also frames the issue I'd like to discuss in more depth. Here's what he says. NATO, as it expands today, is absolutely not what the world of struggling economies and deprived populations require. It is nothing but a negative force. It is undermining an already fragile United Nations. NATO has not been appointed policeman for the world. It is a self-serving organization that lacks integrity, has demonstrated its leadership cannot be trusted, and creates nothing positive. It only yields destruction and human poverty, insecurity and misery. NATO must be abolished. Now, NATO was birthed after the Second World War and then was further developed by the United States and its allies during the Cold War to serve as a military buffer from the possibility of Soviet expansion into Western Europe. At first, NATO's members were only 10 Western European nations, plus the United States and Canada. Today, it has 28 member states, plus several dozen more through the NATO programs, such as Partnership for Peace. Now, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, in theory, NATO's mandate and mission should have ended. To the contrary, not only has NATO expanded into other nations on the European continent, it has also moved into other countries. So, Rick, summarize the original mission of NATO when it was founded and its role during the Cold War, and then describe and compare this with what NATO's missions and mandate is today.
Well, first of all, Gary, thank you for having me back on the show, and particularly at such a pivotal, strategic, and I dare say dangerous moment as we're currently living through. In many ways, evocative not so much with, say, the Czechoslovak crisis of 1968 or the Hungarian one of 1956, but I think even more forebodingly of the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, in that what we're witnessing now is perhaps the most heightened tensions between the world's two major nuclear powers that we've seen in the interim. And I don't believe I'm exaggerating in any manner. I'm glad you quoted from Dennis Halliday, a colleague of his, Hans von Sponeck, who was former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations and was humanitarian coordinator for Iraq, wrote a revelatory, startling, I would even say, article over 5 years ago called The United Nations and NATO, Which Security and For Whom? And it goes item by item over what the purpose of the United Nations is, what the function of NATO is, and how the two are not only not complementary, but that they're diametrically opposed. And this is notwithstanding a backroom deal, which he addresses in the article, made by Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations then and now, and at the time Secretary General of NATO, Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, predecessor of Anders Fogh Rasmussen, a backroom deal that, by the way, circumvented Russia and China as permanent members of the Security Council to effectively make a private arrangement between the United Nations and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. What was the original purpose of the NATO when it was founded in April of 1949? Well, we know the official explanation, which was to guarantee security to U.S. allies in Western and Southern Europe against a, I would argue, non-existent Soviet military threat at the time. But whatever the ostensible purpose for which NATO was created, it started expanding almost immediately. For example, during the Korean War, it incorporated Turkey and Greece into NATO in reward for those two countries, incidentally, sending troops to fight in Korea. Shortly thereafter, of course, the Federal Republic of Germany, which according to both, particularly the Potsdam Accord agreement, should never have been militarized. It was to be permanently demilitarized. Instead, under U.S. and allied auspices, the Federal Republic was remilitarized and brought into a military bloc, which was provocation that led to the creation of the Warsaw Pact, incidentally. As a reaction, we know that shortly after the NATO was set up, military blocks of a comparable nature were established around the world based on the NATO precedent, whose very names indicate that. For example, the Southwest Treaty Organization, Southwest Asian Treaty Organization, CETO, the U.S.-Australia-New Zealand ANZUS Alliance, the Central Treaty Organization, or CENTO, and what is occurring now, however, in the post-Cold War period, and we have to recall that today, this very day, is the 15th anniversary of the beginning of the 78-day air war launched by NATO against the former Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. It really, even though NATO had engaged in bombing in the Bosnian Serb Republic in 1994 and 1995, the 78-day air war in Europe, which is the first time a capital of a European country had been bombed since World War II, we should mention, or was the object of aggression since Hitler and Mussolini's military aggression in the late 30s and early 40s, that this brought NATO into being as a expeditionary war-fighting machine rather than the alleged defensive alliance that it claims to have been. You remark correctly, Gary, that the 12 founding members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, with the exception of Italy, could argue that they were on or near the North Atlantic Ocean at some point. However, the 28 current members, and that represents, by the way, a 75% increase in one decade, from 1999 to 2009. The majority then of full NATO members are nowhere near the Atlantic Ocean. The very name is a lie. And in the interim also, as you indicate, NATO has expanded into a global military force that has now waged war on three continents, in Europe, in Africa, and in Asia. In the latter two instances, I'm talking about Libya and Afghanistan, of course, has a permanent naval presence throughout the Mediterranean and in the Arabian Sea and in the Indian Ocean, which now, with 28 full members and dozens really scores of partners, has over 70 members and partners. That is over a third of the nations in the world. This is, you know, an insult to any notion of peace in the Cold War period or even the post-World War II period. And NATO does represent an unprecedented expansion of a military alliance to a degree and on a scope that is was hitherto unimaginable.
I appreciate your opening insights. Thank you, Rick. Stephen, you're welcome to add anything on to what Rick said. Then I would like you to address the idea that NATO was created as a defensive measure to protect Europe. However, increasingly, we've seen, as Rick mentioned, NATO morphing into a military offensive allegiance to who? To which groups? And although we are repeatedly told that the organization's role is solely defensive, I believe that the intervention into Bosnia, then the war against Yugoslavia that Rick mentioned, and finally the breakup of that nation was a fundamental turning point in NATO's purpose that has redefined its mission. And since you've studied and written on Yugoslavia and the Balkan conflicts under Clinton, I would like you to take as much time as needed to really establish the truth beyond what we have been officially fed, is what happened in Yugoslavia that allowed or encouraged the bombing by NATO of Yugoslavia, the breakup of Yugoslavia into what it is today. So please take your time and address these.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's important to point out that NATO was formed prior to the Warsaw Pact. That we often forget that part, that even though it was nominally formed to protect Western Europe from potential aggression by the Soviet Union and its allies, there was no formal military alliance of the Eastern European countries until after NATO was formed and the Warsaw Pact was formed in response to the formation of NATO. Still, you know, I suppose one could make a case that given that the Soviet Union had incorporated many of these nations against the will of their people into its orbit and effectively installed governments, that there would be concern about Soviet expansionism. I think in hindsight that the fear was an exaggerated one, but it may have indeed been sincerely felt at the time. But what many people assumed during the Cold War, myself included, was that if and when the Cold War ended, NATO would dissolve. I mean, it would no longer have a purpose. Indeed, as part of the deal in which the Soviet Union allowed the communist nations to break away from the Soviet orbit, and when they had the popular nonviolent uprisings that brought down these regimes, the senior President Bush's Secretary of State James Baker promised the Soviets that NATO would not be expanded eastward. But of course, that promise has been broken. I also think it's worth noting that despite all the rationalizations for NATO and the many, many hundreds of billions of dollars of American taxpayer money to keep that alliance going over the decades, that it was not NATO that brought down the communist regimes of Eastern Europe, but nonviolent resistance by the people themselves. Polish dock workers, East German church people, Polish intellectuals, Estonian folk singers, you know, the millions of people who faced the tanks with their bare hands. And I want to mention it simply because, just to underscore the fact that that if you're really interested in challenging autocratic regimes, that there are more effective ways than militarization. Indeed, the threat from NATO, I believe, prolonged the communist regimes because they could use the supposed threat from NATO, just as we use supposed threat from the Warsaw Pact, as excuses for maintaining militarization and domination. But as I mentioned, I think that NATO was more the threat, the exaggerated threat of the Soviet expansionism was more the excuse than the reason for NATO. I believe it was more about expanding U.S. hegemonic interests, And the very fact that NATO has indeed expanded eastward, despite the absence of any kind of credible threat, I believe more is more frankly out coming from the interest of American arms manufacturers and others who wanted to so-called modernize the armed forces of Eastern European countries to make them compatible with NATO, which resulted in huge arms sales and profits for these companies. But to go to Yugoslavia, the one of the big tragedies in Yugoslavia is I think a number of Western nations mistakenly believe that the rise of nationalism within the constituent Yugoslav republics was part of this liberal reform movement that was sweeping elsewhere in Eastern Europe, when in fact, well, there are some elements of that in Slovenia and a couple other places, that by and large it was a reactionary, a primitive nationalism that in some places like Croatia it even had rather fascistic overtones. And and obviously it ended up in a very bloody mess with their atrocities on all sides, particularly from the Serbs. In Bosnia, there there was a internationally mandated so-called humanitarian intervention, in which NATO played a part. But their first action as NATO was far more controversial, and that was 4 years later in Kosovo. And the reason the Kosovo conflict was more controversial is, one, it was not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, therefore it was illegal. Secondly, whereas Bosnia was an internationally recognized nation state, which had asked for international support in response to these Serbian armed militias and their siege and massacres, Kosovo was legally recognized as part of Serbia, so we are essentially intervening within a country's sovereign borders. Now, the people of Kosovo had been waging a largely nonviolent struggle for quite a few years in protest of the Serbs, who were less than 10% of that a nation's population, imposing their rule by requiring Serbian language for all governments and schools and things like that. Very impressive, nonviolent, alternative institutions and the like. But unfortunately, out of frustrations and of their independence, which they had declared back in 1991, not being recognized and getting a little support from outside, a shadowy armed group known as the KLA arose, the Kosovo Liberation Army. These guys, unlike them, were nonviolent Kosovar nationalists, were also chauvinistic. They not only engaged Serbian troops, but they also were killing Serbian civilians and engaging in gun running and money laundering and drug running, and it was a nasty lot. But this gave the Serbs an excuse to crack down even harder, and it was a pretty brutal counterinsurgency campaign by any measure. But it wasn't that much different than, frankly, what Turkey was doing simultaneously in the Kurdish areas, in terms of the civilian casualties. I remember Clinton saying, "We cannot let this kind of atrocities go on NATO's doorstep," when in fact it was going on within NATO itself, Turkey being a NATO member, and in fact with the exception of Israel, more civilians were killed with U.S. weapons by Turkey than any other country. But again, since they were a NATO ally, we were willing to look the other way. Rambouillet, a French city, the United States and other NATO members basically gave an ultimatum to the Serbs to restore the autonomy that the former communist leader and revolutionary hero had allowed, and to get Serbian forces out. But they overextended it. They started saying that NATO should be able to bring troops in and even operate within Serbia itself, which was completely unacceptable. And It was not, I mean, I do believe there was, you know, given the repression going on, it was not unreasonable to push the Serbs in the repression, but it was a take it or leave it kind of thing. It was really, you know, not how you do with conflict resolution. And when the and the Serbs refused, NATO started this 11-week bombing campaign. And what's significant, a lot of people forget, we keep hearing saying, oh, they did this in response to Serbian ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. But the wholesale ethnic cleansing, you know, when they started, you know, forcing hundreds of thousands of people out, that happened only after the bombing commenced. This is in reaction to the bombing. And I want to, and the reason I want to emphasize this is that we keep hearing about rationalizations for so-called humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect, and we ironically look at Kosovo as a successful example. But the fact is that the data shows that in the majority of cases, foreign intervention in cases of severe repression actually increases the violence because it gives the regime the attitude that we have nothing to lose, we can kill even more people, and gives the rebels the idea, oh, we don't have to compromise because we have this great power at our backs. And the bombing continued, and it wasn't just targeting the Serbian militias and engaging in atrocities in Kosovo, but they were bombing these cities hundreds of miles away, hundreds and hundreds of civilian casualties. I have some friends who are part of the pro-democracy movement there, challenging the Milosevic regime, and they stopped protesting and rallied around the regime, because their country was being bombed. They were furious, not just because their friends are getting killed, but because it set back the nonviolent struggle against Milosevic. But the NATO bombing. They destroyed about every bridge on the Danube. They bombed the Chinese embassy twice. They bombed the state media, which killed dozens of journalists who were not necessarily regime supporters, but just professional news people who were doing their jobs, and the final compromise, ceasefire agreement, was sort of halfway between a sort of middle ground between the Rambouillet demands and the counterproposal by the Serbian parliament. In other words, it raises serious questions of whether this couldn't have been worked out without a war. And there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that this push for war was out of the desperate need to rationalize for a need for NATO. Indeed, they're going up to the 50th, they started the bombing just before the big 50th anniversary celebration for NATO, in the hopes that it would just be over for a couple weeks and they could high-five each other and say, yeah, we finally got to have a NATO military operation for the first time in these 50 years. But instead it went on, well beyond then. I'm anything but an apologist for Milosevic, but again, it raises serious questions about, whether this war was really necessary on humanitarian or any other grounds. It was illegal, and again, it seemed to be more as an effort to justify the existence of a military alliance, which should have been dissolved 10 years later with the end of the Warsaw Pact.
I appreciate your insights. Also, we must remember that the NATO forces used depleted uranium bombs and did not tell the people that this would be a forever contamination. The half-life of the depleted uranium is over 4 billion years, and that now we see the effects of depleted uranium, the same type of depleted uranium used, for example, in Iraq, used in Afghanistan. And in fact, when I did my film, Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own, and another film, a documentary, Friendly Fire, there was a hospital in Fallujah, and the doctors gave us thousands of photographs and said, we have asked all the embedded journalists from all the networks, please take these. And they wouldn't take them. They didn't want to share this story. And that is that these babies were being born with such massive genetic defects from the depleted uranium, For example, there were Cyclops babies, where an eye was in the center of the head. There were babies born with no brains in their skulls. And it was only because of the depleted uranium, because this had never happened before. So bad was it that there was a field near the hospital where it had over 1,000 babies. And when you consider this is just one hospital, and not necessarily in a highly densely populated area, and the parents had all been told, don't conceive children at this time because it's almost certain that they're going to end up, because of your exposure to depleted uranium, to these abnormalities and birth defects. Now, recently, the United Nations was shown to have had a report on the bombing of Kosovo, on the bombing in Yugoslavia, and the deleterious effects that it had from the depleted uranium, but suppressed that information, that it was not released, and the American media did not do anything with it. Even if they would have released it, I doubt that the American media, which has absolutely refused to acknowledge the environmental and human consequences of depleted uranium around the world. And that was just one more example. So it's not just the number of people they killed in the battles that you were referring to. It's also what happened to the people afterwards. And I'm concerned because I've done a lot of articles and research on depleted uranium, and it's real. The dangers are real, and they still do not acknowledge that. Now, Stephen, as a follow-up, the excuse for the U.S.'s expansion of NATO on Russia's borders was to serve as a deterrent to Iran's nuclear efforts. And if you listen to any of the neocons on Fox, which are all neocons, I mean, I was thinking about this morning. I'd like your thoughts on this, please. I'm thinking of how much of our American media, including MSNBC, including even some of the programs on Pacifica, unfortunately, have been compromised. Not that they lie, but frequently what they intentionally self-censor or avoid challenge on. Much of the left is just in defense of the current and previous democratic regimes and their corporate ideology, as has the Republicans been on their side. But I'm thinking, who are these panelists? Who are these experts? Well, the moment that there was a conflict with Russia and Ukraine and the Crimea, suddenly they have John Bolton on and others who are, if you look at their background, and I have, and I read the background of John Bolton and his conflicts and his being wrong and his, you know, beating the drums for war and all the other people and the Judith Miller. Why would anyone invite Judith Miller, who was one of, if not the leading journalist in the United States, as a major reporter for The New York Times, having multiple stories on the front page of The New York Times, declaring with absolute authority that her source said that, you know, they had the weapons of mass destruction, when that source had already been proven to be fraudulent, curveball by the German intelligence, and even the core CIA said that this person's information was not credible. But she was getting her information from Dick Cheney's private security apparatus in the White House, where he had his select people. And yet these are the people that end up. And conversely, on the left, the same 5 or 10 boring talking heads, the people from the front groups, the people from the different foundations who come forward, and you know what they're going to say. You know what their position on everything is. A, it's bad media. B, it's completely ideology-based media, and there is no truth. And yet that's what we're told. So little wonder then that we're ever given the truth about Iran, its nuclear capacity, and always pro-Israel. Whether you're on MSNBC or Fox or NPR or PBS, you must be pro-Israel. You can't once talk about what Israel has done to the Palestinians, the apartheid. You can't once mention that because suddenly you're anti-Semitic. And even the arguments that are used to me are foolish. Yet here we are. Here we are with NATO now in the Middle East. And as Rick said, they've been in 3 continents. So would you give us the idea, was this merely a ruse and that we needed NATO to fight terrorist groups in the Middle East on our war on terror? Or is there another real reason for NATO's expansion into the Middle East? And your thoughts upon the lack of objectivity and honesty and integrity in most of the media in the United States. Your thoughts, please.
Are you asking Stephen?
No, yes, Stephen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Repeat the question. I'm sorry.
Your thoughts on the lack of objectivity in the media to tell the truth?
That's kind of a given there is a sort of an assumption of the United States playing a hegemonic role that we somehow are the ones who play this an enforcement role. I mean, let's look, for example, the discussion about Russia's sending in troops to Crimea. I mean, I agree that the annexation of Crimea is wrong, it's illegal, et cetera, et cetera. But who can take seriously the United States saying, when they say we got to lead international sanctions against this? Because when Morocco annexed Western Sahara in 1975 illegally in violation of the UN Security Council, a landmark World Court decision, et cetera, et cetera, instead of imposing sanctions, the United States actually increased their aid to Morocco. Similarly, when Israel illegally annexed Greater East Jerusalem and surrounding areas in 1980 and annexed the occupied Golan Heights in 1981, also illegal, also both actually were condemned by the UN Security Council. But again, while the U.S. supported those resolutions, blocked them from being enforced through sanctions and again increased U.S. aid. More recently, John Kerry and Joe Biden, when they were senators in 2004, endorsed Ariel Sharon's controversial annexation plan to seize large swaths of territory unilaterally, illegally in the West Bank. And it looks like the Obama administration may be willing to push for international recognition of Morocco's Western Sahara annexation as part of that autocratic monarchy's dubious autonomy plan. I'm getting these examples, just the cases. How many times have you heard anybody talking about those things? None. And again, it's not that one should defend what Russia's doing, but this idea that somehow the United States has the moral superiority to try to stand up for this kind of thing, really rings hollow. I mean, we feel so self-righteous. It's very easy to condemn dictatorships or violations of international legal norms if it's governments we don't like, but when our allies do it or we do it ourselves, it's conveniently ignored. It's never brought up in these talk shows. And I remember this big debate on in NPR about before the invasion of Iraq. It was between someone who was saying, we shouldn't push for democracy in the Middle East. We should continue to support our allies for the sake of stability and our interests, even if they're autocrats. And the opposing view was, no, we should support President Bush and his invasion of Iraq in an effort to bring democracy to the Middle East. Like, those were the only choices. It's just indicative, I think, of how little real debate there is, because I think we're just unwilling to look at ourselves like the way the rest of the world does, and recognize that the United States is refusing to play by the international legal norms. We self-righteously insist or our allies, we self-righteously insist that the governments we don't like Russia, uphold their responsibilities.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Stephen. Rick, when I had Professor Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian studies, on this program several weeks ago to discuss Putin, he stated that during Bill Clinton's presidency, the U.S. had essentially breached all the agreements made previously between Mikhail Gorbachev and the first president, George Bush. Gorbachev gave way to assist and aid in the reconciliation of Germany. Both countries agreed not to intervene in each other's domestic affairs and politics, and both had agreed to not build up a military presence on the newly formed borders of Russia. Russia had basically committed itself to these agreements. However, Clinton betrayed all of the Russian concessions, and the belligerent tone Clinton established in his foreign policy has now continued through Bush and now Obama. And we also saw this in the hawkish neocon stance of Hillary Clinton during his term as Secretary of State, or her term during Secretary of State. Now with the Ukraine situation, it's understandable why Russia perceives the U.S. on a path to continue the Cold War and isolate Russia. However, now rather than direct U.S. military operations directed by the Pentagon that poses a threat to Russia, it is NATO. Your thoughts, please.
I mean, that's perfectly true that, you know, the anecdote, of course, that an official in the George H.W. Bush administration assured Mikhail Gorbachev, who seems is either the most credulous man who has ever lived or is a traitor. I'll leave that up to the Russian people, but I think they're, you know, his doing as poorly as he did in the federal election suggests they've made their determination that NATO would not move one inch eastward after German reunification. Well, the very fact that Germany was reunified moved NATO perhaps a couple hundred miles further towards the Russian border, you know, by that very fact. And as we have discussed, that the you know, NATO has expanded by 75%, beginning roughly the same time as the 50th anniversary jubilee that Professor Zunas remarked, and its concurrence with the beginning of the war against Yugoslavia in 1999. Those three developments occurred simultaneously and not coincidentally, incidentally. And that the 12 new countries are all in Eastern Europe. I mean, two out of one, they are either former members of the Warsaw Pact, former Soviet republics, as in the case of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, or former federal republics of the of Yugoslavia, socialist Yugoslavia. So what we've seen now is an erection of a military cordon from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, encompassing the entire western you know, frontier of Russia. Now we see it becoming even more dangerously close, both in the south, Georgia and Azerbaijan, and in the north, and in the west with Ukraine, which has a roughly 1,500-kilometer border with Russia. But you know, you also mentioned the fact about NATO moving into the Middle East, moving in fact into the broader or the greater Middle East, so-called. Morocco, Professor Zunas remarked in 1975, and a parallel to that, of course, was U.S. military client state Indonesia seizing East Timor in precisely the same year, and of course nothing was said about either affair. This has, however, you know, led to Western Sahara coming into the African Union, now African Union. As a full member state, Morocco withdrawing, it to this day is not a member. But Morocco is one of the founding members of one of the programs set up by Mr. Clinton, to reinforce your point, Gary, in the early 1990s, which was the beginning of the expansion, of course, of global partnership programs of the so-called North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The major one was and remains Partnership for Peace. That's the program that groomed the 12 new members and that currently has perhaps 21 additional members in Eastern Europe, in the Mediterranean, two small island nations, one currently and one on its way, that is Malta and Cyprus, respectively, into the South Caucasus, where Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan are all members, into Central Asia. The five former Central Asian Soviet republics are all members of the Partnership for Peace. Actually, Kazakhstan, which borders both Russia and China, has an advanced NATO partnership program. It's the first country outside of Europe to have that. But at the same time, roughly 1994, the Clinton administration pushed a NATO program called Mediterranean Dialogue, which initially and to date includes seven countries in North Africa and the Middle East. They're Mauritania, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Israel, and Jordan. Of course, Mauritania and Jordan are nowhere near the Mediterranean, but we know what geography means to NATO. It's already been announced that after the six-month bombing campaign and naval blockade waged by NATO against Libya 3 years ago, that Libya would join the Mediterranean dialogue. And if and when the U.S. and its NATO allies and its Persian Gulf sheikhs succeed in overthrowing the government in Damascus, Syria will join and Lebanon will join with it, which then means, and I think this is an important fact people should know, that just as the 39 nations in Europe, if you include the South Caucasus, and I'm excluding the micro or mini states like Andorra, San Marino, Monaco, the Vatican, and Liechtenstein, of those 39 countries, every one of them is either a full member of NATO or is in one or more NATO partnership programs. That is, you know, a shocking fact that I think people don't pay attention to. Similarly, every nation in the Mediterranean, either littoral or island nation, now that the left-leaning Akel Party was defeated in the last federal elections in Cyprus, is or will soon be a member of NATO or NATO partnership program, with the exception of Lebanon and Syria, as I mentioned. And all 23 members of the Arab League, with the exception of Lebanon and Syria, currently have some sort of partnership with, or you know, bilateral or multilateral partnership with NATO, every single one. And this this includes even Somalia. And so what you're seeing is the expansion of the, you know, as people have compared it to a new Roman Empire that has turned the Mediterranean Sea into their Mare Nostrum, that has, you know, subordinated the European continent under a common military bloc controlled, incidentally, from the other end of the Atlantic, in a way that Napoleon Bonaparte and Adolf Hitler could only be envious of, I suspect, and is now, as of 2 years ago, shortly before the NATO summit in Chicago here in 2012, NATO announced its latest partnership, the name of which alone is, reveals, I think, the significance of what's occurring. It's called Partners Across the Globe. And the eight initial members, all ones that in one form or another supported NATO's International Security Assistance Force operation in Afghanistan, were under ISAF, 152,000 foreign troops from over 50 nations served under primarily NATO command. Towards the end, I believe only 10,000 of the U.S. troops are not under ISAF command. This is something unprecedented in history. Never have over 50 nations fought in the same war, much less in the same theater of war, and that in one country. And Afghanistan, I have argued, has been employed by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as prime mover of the United States as a laboratory for crafting an international expeditionary, rapidly deployable warfighting force. And this is, you know, the end result. It will feed into things like the NATO response force, the NATO reaction force, and other mechanisms that are in place for that. By the way, those eight nations and partners across the globe are all in the greater Asia-Pacific region. They're Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Mongolia, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. So as I had mentioned earlier, that members of former Cold War military blocs modeled after NATO, like CENTO, and ANZUS and CETO, are now, in fact, being incorporated into a global NATO. This is what we're looking at. In 2004, by the way, before I forget, NATO introduced, and this is very alarming vis-a-vis Iran, of course, that they were creating a new, at which point, by the way, in 2004, it was the Istanbul NATO summit, the largest single expansion of NATO in the history of the military bloc. Seven nations joined simultaneously, including three members, former republics of the Soviet Union, and two federal republics, former federal republics of Yugoslavia. But NATO also announced the creation of yet another program called the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, which aimed at the six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, that is the hereditary monarchies in the Persian Gulf, four of whom are officially members, Saudi Arabia, and Oman de facto are. And there's no question but that the U.S. eyes both Iraq and Yemen as future members of that bloc.
I appreciate that. Stephen, during the last two presidencies, we've seen NATO deeply involved in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was the prime combat force in the invasion of Libya to topple Gaddafi. There is the U.S.-NATO efforts to overthrow Assad in Syria. And now we observe NATO supporting the new fascist parties who have forcefully taken control of Ukraine. How has NATO simply become an extension of the U.S. military? And for NATO member nations that were just really gone into in great depth by Rick, how has this allowed them, in effect, to have the protection of their own country without really realizing the adjustment they've made? Therefore, their military support for U.S. policy interventions is channeled through NATO. And take a look at Libya. There's a classic example. Give us your take on Libya, what it was before the invasion by NATO and what it is today. And why isn't anyone coming forward to take responsibility for all that was predicted and yet as a disaster? And I don't see anyone now saying, I'm glad that I supported that and backed that. Look what we've created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, in Libya, there was a genuine and popular and initially nonviolent movement in Libya against the Gaddafi regime, which had pretty much alienated everybody, left, right, and center. And unfortunately, you know, when you started getting massive defections from the armed forces, when they are ordered to, you know, shoot into unarmed crowds and things like that, a lot of the soldiers brought their guns and then started turning on them on the regime, and it started a civil war. And that then gave NATO the excuse for intervention, saying there is going to be a terrible massacre or whatever. Now, it's really interesting. When NATO decided to join the fray, there had been less than 500 civilians killed, which is terrible, but still, in relative to wars and massacres, it's pretty small. And it's rather interesting. The chief intellectual architect of the so-called Responsibility to Protect, who wrote that influential op-ed in the New York Times calling for international intervention in Libya, was none other than Gareth Evans, who, as a foreign minister of Australia, was the only government that recognized Indonesian sovereignty over East Timor. He defended, rationalized, and covered up for the massacres. He provided military aid and training for Indonesian, you know, occupation troops, and this is we're talking about 200,000 civilian lives in the course of the Indonesian occupation, and then this guy who later went on to be for 10 years the head of the International Crisis Group, he's now a chancellor of Australian National University. He has a nerve, you know, to say, this is such a humanitarian catastrophe in Libya, there needs to be this international military intervention. I just mentioned as a footnote, I pointed this out to him when he and I were on a panel, an academic conference at the University of Melbourne 2 years ago, and he started screaming at me, tore off my conference badge, and threatened to punch me in the face. I guess he had a responsibility to protect his reputation. But anyway, there were a number of people, even those who are in the Arab world and beyond, normally those who were skeptical about U.S. intervention, who did, you know, believe, you know, rightly or wrongly, that a no-fly zone to try to protect the civilians would be appropriate. I was dubious myself, but. One can make a case for that kind of limited role. And the United Nations Security Council, and in Resolution 1776, authorized member nations to use force to protect the civilian population by enforcing a no-fly zone. But instead, what NATO did was went well beyond that mandate and effectively became the air force for the rebels, bombing, Libyan, not just shooting down airplanes that might attack civilians, but bombing, military and government facilities all over the country. And in fact, even after Benghazi, the capital Tripoli, had fallen to the rebels, and there were just a handful of towns that were holdouts for Gaddafi, NATO started bombing those towns, creating a fair number of civilian casualties themselves. I'm mentioning this because, I can see an extreme situation like Rwanda or whatever, genuinely genocidal situation that I could see making a case, for humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect. But, as long as it's dominated by the United States and NATO, darn well it's going to be abused. It's going to be taken advantage of. It's going to be used in dubious situations. And of course, what we have in Libya now is that, even though they did have, democratic elections and a relatively moderate government was elected, you have literally hundreds of armed militias that are running around the country that effectively are the ones that have power, running havoc, they've literally a couple times surrounded the parliament with their guns pointing, forcing them to pass legislation that the parliament might not otherwise pass. They've been fighting over control of the Libyan the Tripoli airport for the spoils. I was reading about an incident recently where a hotel owner threw out a militia leader who hadn't paid his bill in months, and the militia leader came back with his buddies this afternoon and totally shot up the place. I mean, this and then all these arms get loose, including to the hands of some Tuaregs in southern Libya who pass them on to their cousins in Mali, which have this uprising, which then ends up resulting in a coup by a U.S.-trained officer. And in the chaos of that, the Tuaregs end up taking over two-thirds of the country, spreading so thin that then Al-Qaeda types end up taking that over from them, but then therefore justifies French military intervention, of which Al-Qaeda then retaliates by attacking that natural gas facility in Algeria, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, the one reason that the African Union came out against the NATO intervention in Libya was not because they liked Gaddafi. They did not like Gaddafi, but because they predicted that it would create just this kind of series of events that could destabilize a good chunk of the northern part of the continent.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Over to you, Rick. Since NATO is consolidating its military might into blocks to serve Western interests, is this not making the world more unstable? And following NATO's offensive mission, we're also witnessing now counter-alliances forming, such as the Collective Security Treaty Organization between Russia and former Soviet Central Asian states, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization between Russia, China, and their allies. And there is the South American Security Council, first spearheaded by the late Hugo Chavez to create a political military bloc to counter U.S. efforts to intervention on U.S. interests on behalf of Latin American countries. So speak about some of these counter alliances that have formed in recent years as a defensive response to the militant posturing NATO and U.S. has taken. And can you share anything in particular about NATO's threats to Latin American countries?
Several years ago, the same Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, lamented, in my opinion, accused NATO of having a war game called Operation Balboa, whereby using NATO countries' assets in the Caribbean, that's Britain, France, and Netherlands, of course, in addition to the United States. We have to recall the U.S. has reactivated the Fourth Fleet in the Caribbean and for Latin America after a 50-year hiatus. So there are, I'm thinking more particularly of what's known by the acronym of ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our America, also the recently created CELAC or CELAC, Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, 35-nation group, which recently met in Havana and declared their territory, that is all the Western Hemisphere except for the United States and Canada, a nuclear-free zone and a zone of peace. And the Collective Security Treaty Organization evolved out of the former Soviet Union. It's the only security bloc, security military bloc, in the former Soviet Union, and it's comprised of the Soviet of Russia, four of the five former Central Asian republics, Belarus and Armenia. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a security bloc, arguably, but it's primarily transportation, technology, economic, energy organization, one which, by the way, now in various affiliate programs includes even a NATO member, Turkey. And when they met in 2005 in Astana, Kazakhstan, the president of that country greeted the invitees, which included at that time, representatives of India, Iran, and Pakistan as being the representatives of half of humanity, which arithmetically is true. However, at this point, we're not looking at blocks and counter-blocks, I hope, as a motto. We're looking at the demilitarization of the world. We're looking at genuine, peaceful multipolarity. The fact that NATO has, spent some estimated 70% of world spending on weapons of real mass destruction, that is lethal weapons, is an indictment against it enough that, three of the major nuclear powers of the world are founding members of NATO. We can go on with that, but the fact is that one of the problems, I think, is nobody has decided to bell this cat, if we want to use the Aesopian story, the Aesop story, and that the world has permitted NATO to grow incrementally, expand itself throughout continents, throughout the world, ultimately. The next partner, likely, by the way, that's been discussed for a couple of years is Colombia, which, should it become a NATO partner, would implant NATO partnerships or members on all inhabited continents.
Hmm. Well, we're out of time. Thank you very much, Rick Rozoff, and thank you, Professor Stephen Zunis, for sharing your insights about an organization that the average person does not understand and is not given the attention and scrutiny that it should. NATO, its mission in militarizing the world, and as you just suggested in your ending statement there, Rick, to, in effect, to disarm everyone except the countries that they're in allegiance with. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.